Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, April 29, 2014. Progressives in America have lost a powerful voice and a great leader.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Could you have my baby?
We lead today with sad news and a tribute to Tim Carpenter. Tim was a fiery progressive, a smart strategist who developed the left's inside-outside strategy and was a founder of Progressive Democrats of America. I spent many hours talking to Tim Carpenter and always found him to be inspiring and extremely intelligent. His political organizing went back to the Jesse Jackson campaign back in 1988, I believe. And he continued to work on progressive campaigns, working for Dennis Kucinich in 2004. And from there, they planted the seeds for Progressive Democrats of America. And I was always intrigued by the inside-outside strategy. Staying inside the Democratic Party, but continuing to try to push it to the left. And using the organizing of protest and email campaigns and lunch bag sit-ins in congressional offices, even of friendly Democrats. And along with John Conyers, he helped found the Healthcare Not Warfare campaign. And one of my great memories of Tim Carpenter was seeing a line of members of the American Nurses Association as they left a rally and jumped on buses to go protest on Capitol Hill. And Tim had a smile for each of us as he slapped a Healthcare Not Warfare sticker onto our chests. Here's an excerpt from an interview that I did with Tim Carpenter at the very end of 2010. The Obama administration had completed 2 years, and it was clear that progressives had been led astray, had been led on by the hopey-changey campaign of Obama in 2008. And Carpenter was always very honest. So I asked him if there would be a progressive challenge to Obama in 2012. And this is how he responded. What are your thoughts about a potential challenge for the president?
Well, this conversation within Progressive Democrats of America started in July when we gathered our national gathering out in Ohio, which was a really intense debate back then, so it's only intensified. I can say quite honestly, Peter, we're divided within PDA. There are many of us who are part of Dennis Kucinich's campaign, as I said earlier, who understand the importance of an insurgency campaign, that know realistically sometimes you can't win a presidential campaign, but it can serve as a platform, as you said, to raise these very important issues and to continue to move our party in the right direction. Dennis certainly did that in 2004. I think we're an example of that. So there are many within Progressive Democrats of America who feel that challenge is very much in order. It's certainly early right now to think about who that person could be, but to talk about uncommitted slates, committed to health care, not warfare, is certainly a lively discussion within Progressive Democrats of America. Then there's the other question that divides us within the progressive community, and that is challenging an African-American president. When, as white progressives, challenging our first African-American elected president, where are we there? That's going to create its own firestorm itself. So it's a debate that's very much engaging many progressives around the country that we are engaged in. And who ultimately that candidate will be, I don't know. But clearly challenging the president on those issues are very important. And that discussion has begun. In Iowa, we're going to have a meeting in a couple of weeks to talk about running uncommitted slates, committed to health care, not warfare. So we're going to raise these issues. Who the personality will be, I don't know. But certainly, as you said, Peter, this president needs to be held accountable. Just as we started in California at the State Democratic Convention 2 years ago when we passed a resolution challenging Obama on Afghanistan, we're going to continue to push resolutions at the Democratic Party level to challenge this president, whether it be on Social Security, single payer, and as you said, the gross inequities that continue and the abuses and the lack of movement on the torture question. We're coming up on the one-year anniversary now of the commitment to get us out of Gitmo. So there's a lot of issues that we within Progressive Democrats are going to be engaged in. How that will manifest itself, we'll watch that with you over the course of the next year.
There you have the fast-talking voice of the late Tim Carpenter. It's really sad. He was only 55. He had been battling terminal melanoma for a number of years, and I didn't know the nature of Tim's illness. But I knew that he had health issues that he didn't want to talk about. And I'm certain it informed his push for universal single-payer health care in this country. Tim Carpenter, thank you. Thank you for everything you did to try to keep a progressive cause alive and influential here in the United States. A victory for the Obama administration from the Supreme Court in a 6-2 ruling upholding the right of the Environmental Protection Agency to enforce the Clean Air Act on coal-fired power plants. Seems like a no-brainer to me. But, of course, the clean coal industry in this country is extremely powerful. And I think it's something like 60% of our electric power that is generated by coal plants in this country. And so this is a very important step forward to allow the EPA to enforce regulations on the smokestacks of these power plants. And it's a complicated situation because, of course, when the wind blows the effluent from a coal plant, it doesn't recognize state boundaries. And Ruth Gader Ginsburg, the justice who wrote the decision for the majority, quoted from the Book of John, "The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth." And the two dissenters were Scalia and Thomas, who suggest that regulation of the effluent of coal plants is somehow Marxist. And to his credit, Justice Sam Alito recused himself. I'm not sure why, but I support recusals. Clarence Thomas should take note of how it operates and how, when you have a conflict of interest, you shouldn't hear a case. In Texas, one of the biggest bets on the natural gas industry has gone bust. $45 billion was invested in TXU, better known as Energy Future Holdings, by the big Wall Street equity firms like Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts, Goldman Sachs, and it has blown up. Now, the total cost was $45 billion when the leverage buyout occurred. It's not clear. The amount of the bankruptcy could range between $25 and $38 billion. But this was all a big bet that natural gas prices were going to go up. And our friend Steve Horn over at DSmog Blog has helped us understand the outlines of a fracking/natural gas bubble that has developed in that sector of our economy. Now, because TXU imploded over massive debt and its bet that gas prices would go up, I'm not suggesting that this is a direct indication that the fracking bubble is about to burst. But it does show that equity has made big bets in this energy sector. And as we're about to disclose, some of those bets on fracking are losing bets because of the damage caused and because of the diminishing returns when you hydrofrack a certain area. Sure, you get more oil or gas out of it initially, but it appears that it tapers off rather quickly, and that's not what the street has been betting on. So at DSmog Blog today, and I'll link to this article by Brendan DeMille, a jury in Dallas awarded almost $3 million to plaintiffs Bob and Lisa Parr, who sued the Barnett Shale fracking company Aruba Petroleum for intentionally causing a nuisance on the Parr's property, which impacted their health, ruined their drinking water, and forced them to move from their 40-acre ranch. So this is the first fracking verdict in U.S. legal history, and this is an important landmark decision. Now, it'll certainly be appealed, and in Texas, who knows what the appeals court will do. But it does set an important standard that frackers cause damage and that they need to pay for it. And this could have a very, very interesting ripple effect. Meanwhile, I mentioned Steve Horn. His latest article at DSmog Blog, and I will link to it as well, has a bittersweet note because he mentions that over this past weekend, a deadly tornado has swept through Arkansas, and it hit the town of Mayflower. And it was just last March 29, 2013, that the Pegasus pipeline owned by ExxonMobil burst in a Mayflower suburb, sending hundreds of thousands of gallons of really ugly crude goo into the streets of this suburban community. And while Mayflower took a big hit, the bittersweet part of this is that those who were subjected to this unexpected oil flow a year ago, that particular street, that cul-de-sac, was spared by the twister that hit over the weekend. And one more item here about tar sands and energy extraction. The Sierra Club announced today that it is releasing Avoiding Tar Sands Fuel in Corporate Fleets. That's a report and a companion website, which identifies 39 U.S. oil refineries that do not process tar sands crude into gasoline and diesel fuel. And the idea here is that the Sierra Club is then going to use its persuasion and pressure on corporate America not to buy crude from refineries that process tar sands oil. And that's the best way to avoid burning this this very, very destructive product in the fleets of big corporate operators. So they are focused on PepsiCo, on Whole Foods, Walgreens, and Columbia Sportswear. There's a total of 19 companies that have committed to take action on tar sands fuel for their vehicle fleets and their shipping operations. I think this is a very smart move by the Sierra Club, very strategic. And I'll put up a link so that you can check and see if there's a refinery near you that does not refine tar sands-based crude product. And that, if you want to check it out without going to my website, it's refinerycreport.org. I can report to you that this podcast would not be possible without the financial support of our listeners. And I want to thank Wendy Gebauer, Natalie Reel, and Gary Kane. They are all subscribers to this podcast. Gary just renewed his annual subscription for another year. Thanks, Gary. I appreciate that vote of confidence. And I would like you to join them. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, the link says sign up. You get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Best deals, the $50 annual. New annual subscribers in the U.S. get bonus gifts like a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. And a copy of the rockin' CD by John Dist called Red Flag. Those are your bonus gifts, so please sign up today. I do appreciate your support. Disappointing news, another cave-in in the United States Senate. Last fall, the Intelligence Committee voted out a bill regarding the operation of unmanned aerial drones and the people who die when we send them with Hellfire missiles. And the bill had authorized that in 2014, it required the president to issue an annual public report clarifying the total number of combatants and non-combatant civilians killed or injured by drone strikes in the previous year. But it didn't even require the White House to disclose the total number of strikes worldwide. But now we've learned that Senate leaders have removed the language as they prepare to bring the bill to the floor, and James Clapper, the proven perjurer who is also still the director of national intelligence, which is a shameful situation in and of itself, sent a letter saying that the Obama administration is looking for its own ways to disclose more about its highly controversial drone strikes. Now, listen to this language. This is a quote from Clapper's letter to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Quote, The executive branch is currently exploring ways in which it could provide the American people more information about the U.S. use of force outside areas of active hostilities. Do you know what that last part means? Outside areas of active hostilities. Those are illegal operations. Because it means they are not sanctioned in any way by the U.S. Congress. War has not been declared. And so when we strike in Yemen, we strike in Pakistan, in Somalia, or elsewhere. The euphemism is that this is a use of force outside areas of active hostilities. But the other honorable way to describe this is these are acts of terrorism. State-sponsored terrorism by the United States of America. And it's really sad that the Congress, once again, when it has a moment of asserting its oversight role, has backed down, and we are left with the status quo, where things that happen that are not secret, we pretend are secret. I'm a little surprised at the swiftness of this, but the National Basketball Association announced today that Donald Sterling, the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, will be banned for life from the league. It doesn't require him to sell the team, but it probably makes it pretty awkward or difficult for him to continue to operate it. And this, of course, follows the release of a tape that apparently was recorded by a girlfriend where he made these ugly racist remarks. And as I predicted yesterday, the corporate media is all over this story. They love to have a racist clip that they can play. Even the Public Television News Hour played excerpts from this recording. And I have no defense for Donald Sterling. But as I pointed out yesterday, the media is content to milk these moments of racist expression for higher ratings. But they rarely go any deeper and explore the issues of race and discrimination in this country today. As I noted, just last week, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an appeal of Michigan's ban on affirmative action in college admissions, as if racism and racial controversy and conflict is all a thing of the past. And we know that is simply not true. Yesterday, I reported to you that John Kerry had a moment of honesty. He thought he was speaking off the record of the Council on, or no, it was the Trilateral Commission. Apparently, there was a reporter there who captured his remark when he said that Israel, by abandoning the peace talks with the Palestinians, is risking becoming an apartheid state. And as I pointed out, our most recent in-depth interview with the young writers from Gaza makes it very clear that Israel's already an apartheid state. But the apologists for Israel, the AIPAC lobby in Washington, has smacked him big time. And so he's on his knees. He says, well, I've been around long enough to know the power of words to create a misimpression. He said, I would have chosen a different word to describe my firm belief that the only way in the long term to have a Jewish state and two nations and two peoples living side by side is through a two-state solution. Now, Kerry's pretty good at putting his foot in his mouth. He usually does it with extremely long-winded expressions. But he is forced to spin this up and to flatly lie. He says, Israel is a vibrant democracy. Well, Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath, exposes the lie that that is. It's a theocracy. And it's run by extremists who shout down and denounce anyone who attempts to challenge the hysterical interpretation that the extreme voices in Israel take on almost every issue, creating this impression that Israel is a victim And even alleged liberal California Senator Barbara Boxer laid some criticism on Kerry. And on Twitter, she said, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and any linkage between Israel and apartheid is nonsensical and ridiculous. Well, Barbara is the more liberal senator from California, but this defines her quite well. When it comes to Israel, she's not even-handed, she's not fair, she's not objective, she's not even rational. And to declare that apartheid is nonsensical and ridiculous is to show a bias and ignorance about Israel that is unbecoming of a smart United States senator. And I was really distraught to learn just a couple of hours ago in a dispatch from Gaza City that overnight somebody blew up Gaza's Ark. And maybe you heard Anne Wright in my recent conversation with her talking about this new effort to break the Israeli naval blockade of Gaza, not by bringing ships in from Cyprus or Greece or other ports of the Mediterranean, but by embarking from Gaza and sailing into international waters in a way that would challenge the naval blockade. And rather than permit it to get to that point, someone, you can name your own suspects here, decided to blow up the boat. And this statement came from the project manager, Mahfouz Kabariti. Gaza's Ark and all our partners in the Freedom Flotilla Coalition are considering our next move in response to this cowardly act of terrorism. But our position remains clear. Neither this nor any other attack will stop our efforts to challenge the blockade of Gaza until it ends. So, I words fail me at a time like this. And finally today, a new study published by the National Academy of Sciences puts a number on a disgrace of the American justice system that I actually thought was a little bit lower. They have determined that 4.1% of inmates sentenced to death in this country are factually innocent of the crime that they were sentenced to death row for. 4.1%. Now, this is an issue that I have been studying since the 1980s. I've been involved with groups that provide legal services to inmates with a legitimate claim of innocence. And we thought that across the entire population, not just death row, that somewhere below 1% of those sentenced for a felony to state prison were factually innocent. And when you think about all the alleged safeguards we have, that those accused of a crime that carries the death penalty are given legal defense support at the trial level, they get automatic appeals, although the appellate project in California is disgracefully underfunded. And people complain about how these appeals take years. But the whole idea is that while I never have supported the death penalty, if it's going to happen, we want to make sure that it's not an innocent person. And so to get confirmation that 4.1% of prisoners sentenced to death across this country are actually innocent shows how defective our criminal justice system is and how morally bankrupt using the death penalty, given the process that leads to it, really is. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You are free to distribute this free podcast to absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until